We observe the Lord's Supper today. We want to think through the second of our stories of the people who tell us about what happened at the cross, who were not particularly spiritually minded or godly people or even people who were on Jesus' side before the events took place there. Last week we heard from a man who would say to us, "He took my place." This morning, we'd like to hear from a man who, if he could, would say to us, "He welcomed me, even me." And we invite you to think along. You know, there's a striking thing about the reading that Justin did for us a few moments ago from Luke 23. That's Luke's description of what happens as Jesus is crucified. And the striking thing about it is that the whole story of Jesus, of crucifixion, is told entirely in the actions of people. There's no mention at all of a hill, only that it was a place called the Skull. There's no definition of the shape of the instrument upon which Jesus was hanged, nor is there any recounting of the wounds or of the pain that he suffered. The things that we know were there, the things that we often dwell on, but they're not even mentioned in the story. Even the nails aren't mentioned here until they're implied after Jesus is raised up when he shows them his hands and feet to identify himself. Luke 24 and verse 40. Here in our passage, Luke 23 and verse 32 beginning, it simply says, "There they crucified him." And then it recounts what Jesus and the people around him did and said, mostly said. This is a way of telling the story that fits what Jesus is doing for us at the cross. He's bringing people to God. That's what Peter said in 1 Peter 3 and verse 18. "He died once, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God." Sometimes we maybe cheat ourselves and miss the focus of this by thinking that the entire meaning of what happens here is salvation, meaning rescue from what would happen to us at judgment. There are other words that describe the meaning of this. One is justification, one is redemption, another is reconciliation, which means that something is happening here that deals with the distance between man and God and between people and each other. The problem isn't only people's guilt, and the point that isn't merely pain, the pain that he suffers. The problem is the awful alienation and the terrible animosity and the cruel and disgusting inhumanity that exists in our world right now and which is already destroying us. The problem is the enmity between man and the God who made us and whose image we're made. And the point is that Jesus is doing what has to be done at the cross, and not simply bearing the infliction of painful physical wounds. But in him, Jesus is enduring the humiliation of the arrogant, and he's experiencing the loneliness of the unloving, and he's bearing the shame of the shameful. And those things, animosity, humiliation, loneliness, shame, those things are what Jesus wants to heal now. It's through the people in this story, and especially the one thief on the cross, the criminal who's here that he welcomes, that we're able to see our Lord Jesus Christ And what we have met today to remember about him and to see it more clearly than we would have in any other way. Let's start in working our way through this for a moment by just noticing Jesus experiencing the human condition here. He's with two criminals, Luke says, who are crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. They are described as evildoers, criminals. The older versions will say malefactors. They do malevolent things, in other words. Mark and Matthew say they are robbers or thieves who have no respect for others' property or persons. Jesus is in this situation as he told his disciples the night before he had to be. He's being numbered with the transgressors, Luke 23 and verse 37. He's becoming one of us, identifying with us. Both these criminals, one on either side, are in a position to see and to hear what's being said or done that day around him. Either one's in a position to know, but each one is in a situation that would require some personal reflection and thought, and not simply reaction along with the crowd. Now, while the people stand by watching, you just notice here what Jesus is experiencing. While the people stand by watching, Jesus is made the object of scorn. And we've been reading Hebrews in my class, and I can't help but notice that Hebrews 12 and verse 2 says that Jesus endured the cross despising the shame. Would there be anything more like shame than just being the object in your worst suffering of people's stares and they're not doing anything about it? The rulers that day, the religious rulers of the people, scoffed at him, Luke tells us. And Matthew and Mark show us that they don't even talk to him. They're talking to each other, making scorn of him. He saved others. Let him save himself. Think of what that means to us, sitting here today singing about his having saved us. He could have saved himself. He saved us instead. If he's the Christ of God, his chosen one. They're suggesting if he were really that, he surely would see to himself first, not realizing that he was seeing to us instead. The soldiers also joined in. They mocked him. If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. Verse 37. They can't conceive of a king who would not first and last and foremost deal with his own well-being. And then even though both of the criminals also who were hanged there also reviled him, Matthew and Mark tells us to start with, one of the criminals in this situation is still railing at him. Are you not the Christ? Save yourself. In Hebrews 12 and verse 3, it mentions that Jesus endured hostility before even he's endured to the point of the shedding of blood. He's met shame and hostility for no other reason than that he is experiencing the human condition. This whole story, of course, is not about the criminal or the thief. It's about Jesus. He's enduring the humiliation from arrogant people that should have belonged to them and their pride. He's experiencing the loneliness heaped on him because of unloving people who should themselves have been excluded. And he's bearing the shame that comes from the hands of shameful people who should have been ashamed of themselves. All, because he is the Christ, God's chosen, who can save and is doing it. Now, while that goes on, the other criminal begins to face reality. This is the step in the story, which is amazing, given the scene. This fellow is seeing and hearing and thinking. First off, there has been the prayer of Jesus that this man would have heard, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Just as amazing as him praying for the forgiveness of these folks around is the fact that he was calling God Father even in that situation. Then there's the inscription over him. Verse 38, "This is the King of the Jews." Why is that there? What does that mean? Then there are the phrases that are being used by these people who mock Jesus and scorn him and ridicule him. He saved others. The Christ of God, his chosen one, the King, the Christ, save us. You don't hear that in a crucifixion. Where's this coming from? And this thief, this criminal begins to reflect on that and think about it. And then the reality of his own situation. In a world where so often we're accustomed to ignoring how things are for ourselves so we can belittle someone else or criticize someone else, this fellow deals with his own life of alienation and animosity and inhumanity, the things that brought him there, and then what would come next. And he starts changing the hardest thing there is to change, and that's his mind about what everything else really revolves around. He's changing his whole view of things. First off, he rebukes his partner there on the other side of Jesus, who's continuing to say, "If you're really the Christ, get us down from here." He says to him, "Do you not fear God? Don't you have anything you reverence since you're under the same sentence of condemnation? Does it not strike you that someone in your situation should not be making fun of somebody else's misfortune?" Then he takes responsibility for his own condition in life. This fellow does. "And we indeed justly, for we're receiving the due reward for our deeds." He's admitting the wrong that he's done and is accepting the penalty of it. And then, most surprisingly, he defends Jesus while everybody else in that place is mocking him, ridiculing him, and attacking him verbally. He says, "But this man has done nothing wrong." Like Pilate and Herod before him, he's describing the innocence of Jesus. But then, most remarkably, he cast himself entirely on the grace of the man who is hanging right next to him, having been crucified. "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Not some other big demand, but just think of what he's saying. This is actually a believer's grasp of reality. It's the one we express. This criminal knows that God is to be respected and reverenced. He believes there's a standard of right and wrong and understands that he hasn't lived up to it. He asserts that Jesus is King and that the cross doesn't change that fact. And he thinks that Jesus can associate with him and bless him even after both of them have died. What a change in the way of thinking has happened here. And that brings us face to face with what we're remembering today. Jesus' best gift of all, which is a welcome. Jesus gives this criminal crucified with him so much more than he had asked. The fellow has said, "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." And Jesus reduces these things. The two things are not Jesus and his whole kingdom, but now it's, "I say to you," this is now between a Lord and the Lord and an individual. And not when, Jesus says, but today. The man asks, "When you come in your kingdom?" Not when, but today. Right now, this very day. And then, not remember you, but you will be with me. I say to you today, you will be with me. I won't just remember you, but I welcome you. You'll be with me. Remember that the night before, Jesus prayed in John 17 and verse 14, or verse 24. He prayed that these whom God had given him, these disciples, these friends of his, might be with him where he is. And now he's extending that to this criminal. Wow. But then, also Jesus says, and not just when I come in my kingdom, but in paradise. Paradise is used in two other passages in the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 3, which parallel to the third heaven, and Revelation 2 and verse 7, where it's where the tree of life is. At least we can say that it stands for where the righteous go beyond the place where we can see, beyond the passage of life. I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. That's an unexpected welcome, so graciously given. Jesus brings welcome where there was none. That's what his work on the cross was about. He meets us where there is awful alienation and terrible animosity and disgusting inhumanity. And he endures. We shouldn't reduce it in our minds just to the beating, the scourging, the crown of thorns, the nails, the spear in the side, all of which happens. But we should remember, especially the personal attitudes and words that happen here to express rejection and ridicule of the King of Glory. He endures the humiliation that should have been due the proud. He experiences the loneliness that should have been due to the unloving who separate themselves from people by hate. And he bore the shame of people who should have been ashamed of what they'd been saying and doing. And on the basis of what he received from people, which is rejection and insult and shame, he gives people, you and me, what he did not get. And that's humble kindness and grateful acceptance and warm fellowship. And the thief would say to us, "He welcomed me, even me." While we are remembering the Lord at his supper today, consider the possibility that if the Lord's story is told in people who were there, it might be good for us to remember him not merely by recounting the physical blows and suffering, but by recalling what people who were there said and did to inflict spiritual, mental, and emotional harm on him. At the cross, pure love meets shame and hostility and meanness and overcomes it, at least in one crucified criminal's case and in ours. Let's remember today. I don't know everything about paradise or where paradise is, but I believe in the evening of that day, Jesus showed up there with the man who was crucified right next to him. I can't imagine Jesus welcoming that man and not being willing to welcome anyone else. But it depends on whether we're willing to cast ourselves on the Lord's grace like that man did. That man turned out to be the last one Jesus brought to God under the old covenant. When the gospel began to be preached after Jesus was raised up and the new covenant established, when people started asking, what do I need to do to be saved? What they called for would not be a challenge to anyone with the kind of faith that this fellow had. To be invited to believe in Jesus as the Son of God to the point where we're willing to say so, and to change around our way of thinking like that fellow we read about today did, and to be united with what the Lord has done for us through baptism, and to be welcomed, to look forward to that welcome, to be among God's people, is what we still are saying He wants to do for all of us. If that turns out to be a welcome that you want to hear today, if we can help you in responding to the gospel of Jesus Christ, please let us know about your desire while we sing this next song. And please be thinking about these words. Please be standing with us.